Introduction. The Bhagavad Gita is the fountainhead of Eastern psychology, and this commentary is designed to draw out its psychological concepts and make them accessible to all students. These profound psychological insights are intertwined in the Bhagavad Gita with philosophical concepts, so the task undertaken here is to separate the psychological principles and to explain their practical application. Self-realization is the goal of human life. The purpose of Eastern religion, philosophy, and psychology is to fulfill that goal. Philosophy, as it is understood in the East, is neither a mere speculative exercise nor an intellectual adventure. The word philosophy is a compound of two words, philo and sophia, which mean love for knowledge. But this term is not applicable in the East. For those who consider the prime questions of life, such as, who am I? From where have I come? Why have I come? And where will I go? Are not interested in only the intellectual answers to these questions. The subject matter of Eastern philosophy leads the student through a systematic way of directly experiencing the truths of existence and the height of self-realization. After realizing one's real self, one knows that this self is the self of all. In the Vedantic tradition, the term Brahmavidya is used instead of the term philosophy. It has a different connotation and a deeper meaning than the word philosophy conveys, and it is unique in its approach to knowledge. Brahmavidya means the knowledge that leads one to realize Brahman, the self of all. The Bhagavad Gita conveys that wisdom in its entirety and teaches the practical methods for the study and transformation of one's inner being. Philosophy and psychology are thus intermingled. Without the help of psychology, knowing, analyzing, and learning to use our inner potentials, we cannot fulfill the goal of human life, self-realization. In contrast, Western philosophy is intellectual and deals with man's relationship with the universe. With the knowledge he gains, he tries to understand his status in the universe. In Brahmavidya, however, one comes to know all the levels of his being, and finally to realize his true self. According to the Eastern system, knowing the real self is the first and foremost purpose of life. After self-realization, all the mysteries of the universe and one's relationship with the universe are revealed. Because of their contrasting approaches, there is a wide gulf between philosophy and Brahmavidya. One is only theoretical, but the other is practical as well. Though the Bhagavad Gita is composed of only 700 verses, it contains all the principles of the philosophy and psychology of the East. There are 18 lessons in the Bhagavad Gita, each describing a different aspect of the process of self-transformation. This commentary emphasizes the psychological principles found in each chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. The sadhana, spiritual practice, described in each section is explained so that aspirants can help themselves progress in the inward journey and attain the highest state of bliss. The aim of the Bhagavad Gita is to teach the aspirant how to establish equanimity, both in his internal life and in his activities in the external world, to help him develop tranquility within, and to explain the art and science of doing actions skillfully and selflessly. The teachings of the Bhagavad Gita help one to understand the distinction between the real self and the mere self. The mere self is subject to change and destruction. The real self is not. The aspirant should understand both and should firmly establish himself in his essential nature, Atman. Then he can live in the world without being affected by it. In the domain between the real self and the mere self lies our Antahkarana, internal instrument, which plays a most important part in both our internal and external life. If not understood, both goals of life, living in the world and self-realization, are defeated. Our psychological life needs profound and deep study if we are to free ourselves from the quagmire of emotionality, egotistical preoccupations, and self-delusion, and if we are to realize our fullest potentials for the unfoldment of consciousness. The perennial psychology of the Bhagavad Gita deals with analyzing and training the internal processes of the human being so that one becomes creative in the external world and attains a state of tranquility at the same time. That which needs detailed analysis, understanding, and unfoldment is the mental life, which is vast in its characteristics. The outside world can be mastered only when the inner potentials are systematically explored and organized. Without understanding one's inner potentials, it is not possible to function effectively and harmoniously in the external world, for all things happen within before they are expressed externally. The wise man knows the distinction between the real self and the mere self, but he still does sadhana so that barriers are not created for either. Sadhana is for the inner level that creates delusion or mirage. It is not Atman or the external world that creates confusion, but one's mental life. The internal and the external are two inseparable aspects of one single life. Practice, or sadhana, should be modeled in such a way that it does not lead the aspirant from one extreme to another. Some aspirants think that retiring from the world will help them attain the purpose of life. Others believe that doing actions and performing their duties in the world will fulfill the purpose of life. It is the moderate path, however, that creates a bridge between these two extremes and that is the most useful for the general public. This commentary is neither written specifically for the renunciate nor for those who are scratching the surface of the mundane world for the sake of their self-existence, without understanding that if the world is meant for them, they are also meant for the world. If one is to live happily, he needs to be aware that others are also striving to attain happiness. Consideration for others is a primary requisite for finding happiness and building a good society. One may wonder why the Bhagavad Gita came into existence when we already had scriptures such as the Vedas and Upanishads. The great Vedantic sage Shankara explained, "The Vedic Dharma was practiced over a long time, but eventually discrimination and wisdom declined. Unrighteousness became more predominant than righteousness." The Vedas are the source of all streams of Indian philosophy and psychology, and the Upanishads are the later parts of the Vedas. With the decline of discrimination and wisdom, it became difficult for those who were not scholars to understand the teachings of the Vedas and the Upanishads. So it was necessary to restate these teachings in a way that could be appreciated and assimilated by all. The Bhagavad Gita contains, in condensed form, all the philosophical and psychological wisdom of the Upanishads. It is said that the Upanishads are like a cow that Sri Krishna milks to bestow its nurturing wisdom to his dear friend and disciple Arjuna. Sri Krishna imparts all the wisdom of the Vedic and Upanishadic literature through the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. Rather than imparting a new trend of thought or expounding a new philosophy, Sri Krishna modified and simplified the Vedic and Upanishadic knowledge. He speaks to humanity through his dialogue with Arjuna. The word Arjuna means one who makes sincere efforts, and the word Krishna means the center of consciousness. One who makes sincere efforts inevitably obtains the knowledge that directly flows from the center of consciousness. The unique dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna deals with all aspects of life. It is useful for modern therapists, psychologists, and philosophers to study the Bhagavad Gita in order to understand the way Sri Krishna counsels Arjuna. Arjuna, like many patients who seek therapy, is in a state of despair and feels unable to cope with the situation before him. So he seeks Sri Krishna's advice and guidance. But there are major differences in the way Sri Krishna treats Arjuna and the approaches used by psychotherapists today. Modern psychotherapists attempt to help the client modify his conscious attitudes and unconscious processes and behaviors. But their analysis lacks the depth and profundity found in the Bhagavad Gita. Most modern therapists do not explore the purpose and meaning of life. They are loath to discuss and give advice on basic philosophical issues, such as activism versus passivism, one's duty in life, and the nature of life and death. They limit the depth and range of counseling and focus primarily on bringing out the patient's complex. Most modern psychologists do not go to the root of the problem, but analyze it without understanding the fundamental cause. They deal with specific problems and symptoms, and the untouched cause then expresses its agony in different ways. They work in this way because of lack of time and fear of becoming involved with the unknown. By contrast, Sri Krishna presents a philosophical foundation for understanding the purpose of life and the way to live harmoniously, and he offers Arjuna practical advice on living and on coping with the world. In Eastern psychology, the teacher helps the student plan a self-training program and observes all the possible hindrances that may rise to the surface. In Eastern psychology, the whole being is treated. The focus is not merely on the obvious problem. The Eastern method leads one to become a therapist for himself. The path of sadhana is perfect and profound. Modern psychology is still in an evolving state. It is not a finished product as yet. Counselors and therapists play an important role in society, but many of them lack the depth and insight to adequately analyze and advise their patients. They lack self-confidence and are insecure. Because of that, the counselor is unable to guide the client effectively toward the resolution of his problems. Counseling is a very noble profession, but it is taken too lightly. It is often practiced by erratic and egotistical people who are not interested in developing themselves, but who are only interested in teaching. The same problem exists with those modern gurus who can theoretically explain, but do not ever practice. Therapists and gurus can be more dangerous than anyone else when they exploit the innocence of others. We must find a way to keep this noble heritage and this wonderful profession from degeneration. It is through sadhana, spiritual practice, alone, that one can come in touch with his inner self. Without that, trying to help others is like building a castle in the sand. It will crumble in the first rain shower. In the Bhagavad Gita, the protagonist Arjuna is a most brilliant sadhaka, one who follows the spiritual path, and warrior. He had been trained to skillfully fight the battles of life, yet even he becomes confused like any other person. According to the Bhagavad Gita, confusion can lead to serious conflict, and if the conflict seems unresolvable, one can lose all incentive and become desolate. The purpose of his life will then remain unfulfilled. Like many clients in psychotherapy, Arjuna is not at first receptive to the guidance of his preceptor, Sri Krishna. In the second chapter, after his initial arguments with Sri Krishna, Arjuna finally begins to listen to the teachings imparted to him. It is important to stress here that modern therapists and teachers need to establish rapport with their clients and students, who will be more receptive to advice when a sincere and friendly atmosphere is created. According to the Bhagavad Gita, Atman, the real self or center of consciousness, is never changing, everlasting, eternal, and infinite, whereas the body is constantly changing and prone to decay. Between the body and the Atman is the mental life, which needs to be understood in its totality. The Antakarana should be understood, analyzed, and trained to allow the light of Atman to be expressed and to enable one to live in the world while remaining undisturbed by worldly fetters. After explaining both the immortal and mortal aspects of existence, the Bhagavad Gita describes all aspects of yoga psychology. Atman cannot be known in the same way we usually know something, that is, as an object to be perceived, understood, or acquired. For Atman already exists and is the source of all one's knowledge. It is the basis of knowing rather than an object to be known. That which is the subject matter to be known is our mental life and the way we should function in the world. All the systematic efforts and practices described in the Bhagavad Gita are means to organize the internal life so that human beings can attain a state of tranquility and thus become useful to themselves and others. The psychology of the Bhagavad Gita leads the student first to awareness of the center of consciousness, then to training that focuses on the understanding and mastery of one's internal states, and lastly, to the skillful and selfless performance of actions in the external world. Comprehension and knowledge of Atman are essential to fully understand the internal state of mental life. And without an understanding of the various aspects of one's mental life, coordination between mind, senses, breath, and body is impossible. So knowledge of Atman in itself is not enough. Application of this knowledge is paramount. It is Atman alone that gives light to the prime faculty of our internal being called buddhi, intellect. Buddhi has three main functions: discrimination, judgment, and decision. In Western psychology, these three qualities of buddhi are considered to be aspects of the ego. In other words, they are intimately connected with one's limited subjective sense of I. It is I who discriminates, judges, and decides. Eastern psychology, however, shows that these three functions of the intellect are distinct from the ego. That is, they are not necessarily connected with one's limited subjective sense of I. In this view, the powers of discrimination, judgment, and decision need not be expressed within the more circumscribed perspective of one's ego. No action can be performed without the help of the mind. All the actions and speech of a human being are governed by the mind. Therefore, that which needs the most attention in developing a practical way of living is our mental life. Training the mind means making the mind free from all complexes, and in sadhana, all the faculties of mind are trained in a unified way. This is important because one-sided progress is exactly like knowing half a truth, which is not a truth at all. Commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. There are many ancient and revered commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, each of which has a unique emphasis. The most prominent are those of Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhava. The most ancient commentary on the Bhagavad Gita known to the modern world is that of Shankara, AD 788 through 820. He refers to still earlier commentaries, but they are not available. According to Shankara, the Bhagavad Gita leads one beyond action and beyond all the distinctions of the phenomenal world to the realization of the Absolute. Shankara views the Bhagavad Gita as an expression of Advaita philosophy, and he uses the Bhagavad Gita to support his assertion that there is only one reality without a second. His commentary emphasizes the identity of the self with Brahman as the only reality. In this view, the phenomenal world is illusory, and taking it to be real creates bondage and suffering. Only direct knowledge of the ultimate reality can bring freedom. Though selfless actions help to purify the mind, ultimately one goes beyond action and renounces all involvements in the mundane world. Ramanuja's commentary, 11th century AD, emphasizes the devotional aspect of the Bhagavad Gita. Ramanuja interpreted the Bhagavad Gita in accordance with his dualistic philosophy, rejecting the view that the self and Brahman are identical. His commentary argues against the renunciation of action and asserts that the phenomenal world is real rather than illusory, although it is totally dependent on God. In Ramanuja's view, God is not beyond form, nirguna, but is a personal being with form, saguna. God is immanent within every human being, but the human being always remains distinct from God. According to Ramanuja, the Bhagavad Gita teaches that devotion to Vishnu is the highest path. Madhava's commentary, 13th century AD, also interprets the Bhagavad Gita from a dualistic framework and criticizes the monistic view that there is only one consciousness. He asserts that devotion is the only means for attaining liberation, and he attempts to show that the Bhagavad Gita supports his view. Of the many 20th century commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita, a small number are widely read and respected. Each of these has a unique emphasis. In the first half of this century, a number of those who led India to independence from alien rule wrote commentaries that focus on karma yoga. Tilak, a prominent leader in India's quest for independence, asserts in his Gita Rahasya that the Bhagavad Gita emphasizes karma yoga. Tilak stresses the importance of undertaking action not for personal reward but based on selflessness. Mahatma Gandhi also wrote a commentary on the Bhagavad Gita that stresses action based on truth, nonviolence, and selflessness. The commentary, by his follower Vinoba, emphasizes actionless action, that action which combines action with renunciation. Sri Aurobindo wrote a collection of essays which assert that the Bhagavad Gita offers a synthesis or integration of the various paths of yoga, notably Jnana Yoga, Karma Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga, the yogas of knowledge, action, and devotion, respectively. Aurobindo attempted to reconcile the dualistic and non-dualistic interpretations of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna Prem, an Englishman who lived in the Himalayas as a yogi during the later part of his life, contributed a commentary that has given insight into the symbolic significance of the Bhagavad Gita. He emphasizes that the battle is taking place within, between the negative forces of greed, selfishness, and desire, and the noble qualities of the human being that can lead to self-realization. One of the most thorough and meticulous commentaries is the four-volume work of Satwalekar. His commentary makes many comparisons between the Bhagavad Gita and the Upanishads and other scriptures. He refers to previous commentaries and presents detailed discussions of the fine points of many verses. Since he was a practicing yogi as well as a great scholar, he was able to bring out many subtleties in his translation and commentary that are missed by other translators and commentators. Dr. S. Radhakrishnan has written a well-known commentary that is primarily philosophical in nature. He often refers to previous commentaries, particularly that of Shankara, and to relevant passages in the Upanishads. However, he does not give much insight into the practical applications of the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. The present commentary is unique in emphasizing the practical application of the many facets of the Bhagavad Gita's teachings. It does not exclusively emphasize action, devotion, or renunciation, but delves into the way in which each of the paths and practices described in the Bhagavad Gita may be utilized to attain the absolute. Historical background of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is unique among philosophical and psychological teachings, for it begins as two great armies confront one another at the start of a battle, and the teachings continue for 18 days in the midst of the battlefield. Most Western readers who read this scripture for the first time become confused by the first chapter, which describes the battlefield, for there is no introduction to inform the reader of the cause of the war and who the protagonists are. Many readers are not aware that they are reading a scripture from the longest epic poem in the world, 8 times longer than the Iliad and Odyssey combined. The Bhagavad Gita is a mere 700 verses out of the 100,000 verses of the Mahabharata. If the reader were familiar with the Mahabharata, the events of the first chapter would be easily understood, rather than being enigmatic. But without knowing what came before, the reader will be confused and will not fully appreciate Sri Krishna's counsel. The Mahabharata records all the events leading up to the battle, explains the battle itself, and tells what came after. These events are said to have taken place some 5,000 years ago, but for our purposes, the epic's historical authenticity is not important, for we are concerned with the profound psychological insights conveyed in the Bhagavad Gita. The Mahabharata is a source of great wisdom about how to conduct one's life skillfully and harmoniously, and it should be studied as a work of profound insight into psychological functioning. A brief sketch of it is provided here in order to clarify the context of the Bhagavad Gita. Dhritarashtra is the eldest son in a royal family. Ordinarily, he would have become king, but since he had been born blind, his younger brother, Pandu, assumed the throne. In time, Pandu had 5 sons, of whom Arjuna, the protagonist in the Bhagavad Gita, is the second. Dhritarashtra had 100 sons, the eldest of whom was Duryodhana. The war is between the sons of Pandu, the Pandavas, and their cousins, the sons of Dhritarashtra, who are called the Kauravas. Duryodhana is the leader of the Kauravas, and Arjuna leads the army of the Pandavas. Pandu died at an early age, so his 5 sons grew up under the care of their uncle Dhritarashtra, who usurped the throne. All the cousins were brought up together in the same household and had the same teachers, the most notable of whom were Bhishma and Drona. Dhritarashtra favored his sons over his nephews, and he tolerated their wicked acts. But the sons of Pandu had many outstanding qualities. They were virtuous, superior in archery, and favored by the elders. Thus Duryodhana became envious of them. Yudhishthira, the firstborn of the Pandavas, is the rightful heir to the throne, but Duryodhana conceived several plots to kill his cousins and to send them into exile so that he could become the king instead. For example, he built a palace made of wax for his cousins. This was extremely flammable, and when he thought they were asleep, it was set afire. But as a result of divine intervention, Arjuna and his brothers escaped. Duryodhana also tried to poison and drown the Pandavas, but failed. Twice appealing to Yudhishthira's sense of honor, Duryodhana goaded him into a crooked game of dice. The first time Yudhishthira lost the entire kingdom, but it was soon restored to the Pandavas. On the second occasion, Yudhishthira was again cheated and lost. As a result, the 5 brothers were not allowed to enter the kingdom for 12 years, during which time they went to the forest, where they led an austere and spiritual life. After 12 years of exile, they were permitted to return to the kingdom, but it was required that they live unknown and in disguise for 1 year. If their identity were discovered, they would be exiled again. As with all of the Mahabharata, these events are symbolic, for the Mahabharata is not merely a story concerning a historical event. It is symbolic of the inner process of self-transformation and self-realization. The entire epic explains through symbols the sequential stages in that process and the experiences that one must undergo in the heroic journey of self-discovery. For instance, a period of exile in which one lives in the wilderness and purifies oneself in preparation for spiritual awakening is a common theme that occurs in history, myths, and initiation ceremonies throughout the world. For example, consider Jesus' 40 days in the wilderness before returning to Jerusalem, Moses' retreat to the mountain for 40 days before receiving the Ten Commandments, and Buddha's prolonged period of meditation under the Bodhi tree before he was enlightened. Once the Pandavas successfully completed their trial, they sought to have their kingdom restored, but Duryodhana would not give them their legal and moral rights. The Pandavas would have been content with a small village for each brother, but Duryodhana told them that he would not even allow them as much land as could be placed on the point of a needle. The Pandavas tried every means to avoid fighting to regain their rights, but the battle was forced on them. The war was not fought merely to regain mundane wealth and power, but was in fact a war between the just and the unjust, between good and evil. Symbolically, the armies represent the positive and negative forces functioning within the human heart and mind. The battle is waged to decide whether the positive or negative forces govern the city of life within the human being. There is a constant battle going on within each person to regain the lost kingdom of peace, happiness, and bliss. Duryodhana and his 99 brothers represent the evil desires that exist within each human being, whereas the 5 Pandavas represent the virtuous and noble qualities. When one's reason is blinded by evil designs, it is impossible for him to live peacefully in the world. The Pandavas tried their best to solve the serious problem that arose as a result of the unjust and unrighteous ways of Duryodhana. Finally, there was no choice left for the Pandavas but to decide to fight with full will and determination. As the two sides began gathering their armies, both went to Sri Krishna and sought his support, for he possessed the strongest army, as well as being revered as the wisest teacher and the greatest yogi on the earth. Both Duryodhana and Arjuna requested Sri Krishna to support them in fighting the war. Sri Krishna, the center and source of all consciousness, wisdom, and knowledge, offered to give his vast armies to one of them and to become the chariot driver and counselor for the other. Duryodhana chose Sri Krishna's vast army, for he was greedy and materially oriented. Arjuna preferred to have Sri Krishna as his counselor and guide. Before the battle, Sanjaya, considered to be a wise counselor, was sent to the Pandavas' camp in order to confuse them and weaken their resolve. He tried to dissuade them from fighting, but disappointed that they did not agree to call off the war, he returned to Dhritarashtra, the blind father of Duryodhana. At the start of the Bhagavad Gita, the two armies are facing one another on the field of Kurukshetra, and the battle is about to begin. Dhritarashtra is standing on a hill with Sanjaya, overlooking the battleground, and he requests Sanjaya to narrate all that is taking place on the battlefield. The first chapter of the Bhagavad Gita offers a glimpse into those who are taking part in the battle and sets the stage for the dialogue between Arjuna and his preceptor, Sri Krishna.